Zoe, thank you very much. And Reem, thank you very much for setting this up. This is great. And I want to thank Steve Roth in absentia. I trust he is enjoying the suntanning, but I want to thank him as well for making this possible. This is the first of a three-part mini-series, and our business ethics topics this week are for this series, I should say, are sort of debt-oriented. So we're talking bankruptcy this week. Next week is ramifications of a bounced check. And then the third week is what one can do to a debtor in order to get him to pay the debt, including can you force the debtor to pursue work in order to have him repay the debt, and some interesting related cases that will come up in that discussion. Please do make sure that you sign in. I use the sign-in sheet to be able to email out afterwards the link where you can find the audio recording online, as well as answers to questions that come up during the session. As always, when I speak about practical matters, I caution you that for practical questions, please speak to your rabbi. I'm giving a general sense of topics, but I'm not. I believe that people should go to their synagogue rabbi for full and final answers. I gave you at the top of the sheet. I gave you a link to a very good article written on the topic of bankruptcy, and I wanted to make sure to promote it here. You can find this article online by Professor Stephen Reznikoff. It's an excellent introduction to the issues of bankruptcy, more than an introduction, really an overview. So I want to address two principal questions. Question number one is, does Jewish law recognize a secular bankruptcy discharge? So when a bankruptcy is carried out, does Jewish law recognize it? And then the second question that goes along with that, am I allowed to help a Jew to file for bankruptcy? Those are two issues that I want to get to. But in order to get there, we have to begin with the question of, does Jewish law recognize bankruptcy? What is bankruptcy from a Jewish perspective? So we begin by noting that there is a basic mitzvah of repaying debt. A Jew who borrows money is obligated to repay it, and there are several different sources that are brought in support of this idea. If you take a look on the sheets, source number one comes from Rashi, the classic commentator to the Talmud. And he writes, Mitzvah alav lifroba chovo la'ameis devarav. He's commenting on a Talmudic source, which actually describes the ability of a rabbinical court to compel people to pay their debts. And he explains that the reason why the court is empowered to do that is because the court in general is empowered to promote the observance of mitzvot, of the Torah's commandments, and repaying debt is one of those commandments. And he says there's a mitzvah for a person to pay his debt and fulfill his words. Where does he get it from? Dichsiv, because the Torah says, Hin Tzedek. In the context of the Torah's statement that people are responsible to keep honest weights and measures, the Torah mentions different types of measures that have to be honest, and one of them is called a hin. And so what Rashi notes there is that the word hin can be understood as the word hain, which means yes. So in addition to your measure being honest, your yes, your hain, must be honest. When you say yes to somebody, as in when you borrow money and you commit to repay, that must be an honest yes. When you say yes, you have to be honest, and when you say no, you have to be honest. That's what Rashi says. So there's more to be said about his specific lesson from that verse, but the point for us is he makes the positive assertion that there is an obligation to make sure that you will fulfill your word. When you say you're going to repay, you are obligated to do so. That's one source. A second source in support of it is brought in source number two. Thanks. You know what, Dory, maybe we should leave it on the table for people to come in. Thanks. Second source for it is source number two, which also, we're going back to the 13th century for this one. I'm trying to show how, in general, in Jewish tradition, we've developed this idea that there is an obligation to repay one's debts. So here, this is a comment from Rabbeinu Yom Tov Elashbili, in which he says, V'hikshu alav b'tosvos. He says, I don't like the source that Rashi brought in source number one. He doesn't accept that as the source for the obligation to repay one's debts. Because he says, if you look at what's there in source number one, that's an obligation for somebody to mean what he says. You follow? In other words, Rashi's way of framing this was, when you say yes, it has to be true. What about the case of a borrower who fully intended to pay back his debts, but then at some point in the future, before the debt came through, before the debt came due, I should say, his finances collapsed. He didn't violate the mitzvah of make sure your yes is true. When he said, yes, I'll repay, he was 100% sincere. So Rashi, according to you, his obligation is over. He meant to repay. Even if he didn't end up repaying, nonetheless, he was sincere about it. So therefore, source number two, Rabbi Elashbili, provides a separate source for it. And he writes that there's a different source. And the different source is from a verse from Deuteronomy, from the book of Devarim, in which we are told that there is an ability of a creditor to go to a court and say, I have not been paid back, and the court can send somebody into the debtor's property to claim property that will be used, to claim assets that will be used to pay off the debt. That's what it says in source number two. I'm not reading it aloud because the text itself is a little bit stilted for it. But what he's saying is, from the fact that the biblical text says that the rabbinical court is able to send somebody into his property to claim assets, that proves that there's an obligation to repay the debt. Because if the guy didn't have an obligation to repay, by what right would you be sending somebody into his property to claim payment? Clearly there's an obligation to do so. That's his. That's a second source for it. And then there's a third source, which is probably the harshest worded source, and that's in source number three. I didn't put a century on it, but I believe it's late 15th, early 16th century, Rabbi David Ibn Avi Zimra, in which he phrases it in the most harsh of ways. He says, payment of a debt is mitzvah asei shel Torah. It is a biblical mitzvah to repay a debt. And he quotes you a verse, and he shall return the object he stole, or the money he withheld, or the charge placed in his care, or the lost item he had found. According to him, failure to repay a debt is the equivalent of theft. You are holding property that rightfully belongs to somebody else. That's a, I think, a very harsh formulation of it, but that's what he's saying. It doesn't matter that it came into your hands legitimately, the person lent you the money willingly, nonetheless, once it's due, it's theft to hold it. Yes?
So, according to the second source, there's an obligation to repay the debt and seize the asset, but if the debt had no security against it, there's still an obligation to seize the assets.
Correct. Even where there was no security, nonetheless, at the time when the debt comes due and the fellow defaults, the court is able to go in and effectively create security. Except that what they take out can actually be used to pay the debt. If there's a security, that's what they're going to take. But in the absence of any arrangement, they're going to take whatever they find within certain limits, which we'll get to in the third week. When we talk about what you can compel a debtor to do, there are certain arrangements that have to be made on behalf of the debtor. But barring that, there's an awful lot that they're able to take. Yeah. Yes?
Obviously, when these rules were developed, they were dealing more with actual loans. And in this sense, we're dealing sometimes with consumer debt, which isn't a loan in the traditional sense, but
correct.
Sort of buying something on credit.
Right.
But do these contemplate the exact...
Yeah, they actually had that as well. They had consumer debt, buying on tab, and you know, wouldn't necessarily have had all of the bells and whistles that today's version will have. You didn't have a credit card. But you did have consumer debt in those days, and yes, it's discussed in that context as well.
Yes? That's correct. We have in mind, let's say when we paid a Visa...
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. You are fulfilling a mitzvah when you pay your bills. They make you feel good, huh? Yeah. Dory.
Source number three. Why would you consider him being harsh in that if someone had the intention to take the money or to purchase the debt or whatever it is, have to pay it back, but then they don't, it really is debt.
Yeah, it's just stronger than the other two formulations, right? The first formulation was you have to be an honest person. The second was just deduced from the powers of the rabbinical court. Here you have Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimmer, Radbaz, saying, no, the person who hasn't paid back is a thief. I think that's a very strong formulation. What emerges from this, and by the way, there's a completely separate source, which I didn't bring here, a verse in Mishlei in Proverbs, which talks about lo verasha velo yishalem. A borrower is wicked if the borrower does not pay back. I'm not bringing that because that one is specific to the case of somebody who has the ability to pay and refuses to do so. These other obligations apply even to somebody who doesn't have the ability to pay back. But that one is, that harsher formulation is when the person refuses. So the question is, now that we have built up the obligation to repay debt, what happens if a person can't do so? Well, in contemporary law, there's a concept of bankruptcy, which is fairly modern. When you go back to the Code of Hammurabi, there was the possibility of liquidating a person's assets to pay the debt. There was no option of discharging the debt. What there was slavery and imprisonment, but that's basically it. In the year 594 before the Common Era, Solon changes Athenian law to allow a debtor to forfeit his citizenship and then have his debts absolved. And that could be considered, I suppose, a form of bankruptcy, except that it's kind of, you know, draconian, if I can mix my lawgivers. You lose your citizenship in order to achieve that end. The Justinian Code in the year 533 of the Common Era is the first one to actually allow for absolution of debt. And the first formal bankruptcy statute is in 1542 from Henry VIII. Today, the process, as I understand it, is that a proposal is made to creditors to pay a percentage of what is owed over a specific period of time, perhaps to extend the amount of time to pay the debt, some combination of that. Creditors then vote to accept or reject the proposal. And there are some differences. There are commercial proposals, there are consumer proposals. But once all the terms of the proposal are met, then the debtor is legally released from the debts included in the proposal, and from then forward, no creditor is allowed to go after the debtor in order to get additional payments beyond that which has been agreed to in the proposal. And as part of this, the debtor has to disclose all his assets and anything that's been disposed of in the last few years, surrender credit cards, assist the trustee who's administering the bankruptcy, and so on and so forth. What's the theory behind having bankruptcy statutes like this? Why do governments approve of allowing somebody to pay less than what he owes? What's the rationale?
Encourage risk taking,
right? There's a safety net, right? Good. Someone else I heard say fresh start. It gives you a blank slate. That's in his advantage, not necessarily the lender's advantage. But part of it, you're right, is the safety net. Yeah.
Rehabilitation of the debtor.
Rehabilitation of the debtor, right? You need to give the person an opportunity. You need to have another chance. That's another reason. Dory.
A lot of times the debt accumulated is made up of more interest than the actual principal borrowed. So in some of these negotiations, at least the person lending gets back what the actual amount they lended foregoes the income they would have made.
Right.
But at least the very principle is what they're trying to get back.
Right. To a certain extent, this actually helps the creditor. It encourages repayment to some extent, at least, and it encourages cooperation. It also is an aid to society in other ways. It reduces, frankly, the incentive for criminal behavior, because people have a way to make things right. So that's a positive. It also encourages wise lending, right? Think back to the credit crisis of a few years ago in the U.S. In the event that the lender knows that he might not get it back, he's less likely to extend such a loan. there's a lot. There are many different motivations for this, but what we've said can essentially boil down into three different categories that are going to matter for us. One is that it helps society for the various reasons that we gave. Entrepreneurship, reducing the burden on society, they don't have to support an eternal debtor, encouraging wise lending. There is the fact that it helps the debtor, clearly, blank slate, giving him another chance. And there is the help to the creditor as well in terms of encouraging the cooperation of the debtor and getting some repayment. So looking at those motivations, which are all, I think, honorable and positive, which of those make it into the Jewish system, into a bankruptcy law? And the answer is none. There, within Jewish law, there is no concept of bankruptcy, and it has never been innovated. Which is odd, and we have to figure out why. You know, some people, when I talk about this topic, will mention the sabbatical year, Shemitah, how every 7 years, debts that are due and have not been repaid are canceled. This is not bankruptcy law, right? Because it's regardless of your ability to repay. It's universal. Interestingly, the modern Hebrew phrase for bankruptcy does originate in the Talmud. Anybody know the phrase? Poshet regel, right. Pshitat regel. It means extending your leg. So that actually originates in the Talmud, Ksuvos Kohes. But the context there is actually someone who extends his leg as a signal that I am refusing to pay. It's not a bankruptcy arrangement. There is, within Jewish tradition, a firm requirement to be kind to the borrower. So a creditor is not allowed to go to a borrower who he knows cannot pay. He's not allowed to go to him, putting him in a position of feeling guilty and feeling terrible about his inability to repay. It is a wonderful thing we are taught to cancel people's debts. That's an act of chesed. It's an act of kindness. It counts as tzedakah. It's philanthropic. And there are rules governing how debts are claimed that we'll get to, I hope, in week three. But there's no biblical bankruptcy discharge, and down through the centuries, the rabbis never instituted one, and I think there are two reasons for that. Reason number one is because there is no religious... Reason number one is because there is a religious duty to repay. From a secular perspective, the reason why we want people to pay their debts is a social obligation between one human being and another and for the sake of society. While society may have a compelling interest in forgiving certain debts, and that will override society's desire for people to repay. Within the Jewish approach, though, we spend some time articulating the obligation to pay one's debts as a religious obligation. It's between man and God. So granted that the creditor may have certain rights abrogated in order to take care of his duty to society, so he can't keep on going after the borrower whose inability to pay and things like who is unable to pay and so on. But the debtor will still have a personal obligation to repay no matter what you do. I can forgive what somebody owes me. I can't forgive what somebody owes God. So that's one piece of it. But the other reason, which I think is actually in some ways more important, is Jewish economic policy in general. When you go back to biblical times, and it's true going forward from then as well, but you see it really, really clearly biblically, lending is viewed as tzedakah, as philanthropy. Lending was not viewed as a business deal, a business endeavor. It was viewed as a way to keep people on their feet. If you take... Sorry?
Not only that,
it's
forbidden.
Lending?
As a business.
Oh, as a business. You're talking about usury. We'll get to that. Good. Take a look at source number 8, please. Number 6 was the verse for the sabbatical year. But if you take a look at number 8... In kesef talves ami, when you lend money to my nation, es ha'ani imach, to the pauper with you, you shall not be a noshed, like somebody who has a claim going after the debtor. The assumption is that loans take place in the context of helping someone who is in need. Because it is tzedakah, because it's considered philanthropic, we want to encourage it for reasons that are religious, as well as reasons that are practical. We want to make sure that we keep credit going. in the event that you engage in a bankruptcy proceeding and the creditor says, well, I'm not getting back that which I lent out, then you're making lending less likely. It can have a chill, bankruptcy laws can have a chilling effect on lending. We don't want to create that kind of a circumstance, that kind of a situation. We have all sorts of laws that are meant to promote an atmosphere of lending. So one, which was mentioned before, the prohibition against lending with interest, right? What do we call, from an economics perspective, economics 101, what do you call lending somebody without charging interest? Thank you. What else do you call it besides interest-free loan? We call it foolish, right? Because from a best case scenario, okay, I get paid back on time, I've still lost opportunity cost, and I've still lost cost of inflation. I will never get back that which I lent out. There's no reason to do it. The only reason to do it is because you want to help somebody. It's meant to be philanthropic. It's foolish but helpful. It's philanthropic. For a person to extend an interest-free loan is a way to help somebody else out. It's not an investment. You'll never do well with that kind of investment. So that's one example of how the sages tried to encourage this sort of lending. I brought you another example in source number 9. It's a passage from the Talmud. They're talking about what type of judges you need to adjudicate different financial issues. So the rule is that if you want to try a case, normally you need 3 experts. However, when it comes to debts, where a person is challenging his debt, if I want to bring him to court, I just need any 3 judges. They don't have to be experts. Why in the world would we say you don't need experts? Because they were concerned that if a creditor thinks to himself, if I ever need to bring this guy to court, I'm going to have to go find 3 experts who will hear the case. Forget it. It's too hard for me to actually make sure that this guy's going to pay me back. He's not going to extend the loan. So therefore, we lower the threshold for what he's going to need in order to claim payment. Another passage in the Talmud empowers creditors to collect from heirs of the debtor, specifically in order to ensure that people want to lend money. There's another passage in the Talmud that talks about quality of currency. In those days, when you're not dealing with our types of currency, coins made out of various metals had different quality to them and were acceptable in different arenas. So, letter of the law, the person who owes money to the creditor should be allowed to pay back with the lowest level of currency. Letter of the law, that's what they should be able to do. The equivalent of going to your creditor and paying him back in pennies. However, the rabbi said, if we do that, once again, people are less likely to lend. And they bumped it up and said a borrower is obligated to pay back with the intermediate quality of currency in order to encourage, once again, to encourage lending. Yes?
I may not be getting here something here, but they seem like 2 incompatible objectives. On one hand, you're saying it's a chesed, it's tzedakah, meaning that there's no necessarily business or economic policy in my mind as a lender when I'm making a loan. I'm just giving it out of the goodness of my heart because of Shem's. But on the other hand, we're saying, well, we do kind of have to act as a kind of a little bit of a loan shark, saying you need to pay back irrespective of what your financial situation is. Those 2 things, one of them is human heart and emotion, and one of them is cold-hearted business or cold-minded business. They don't seem compatible. How does Jewish law reconcile?
Right, and that's exactly right. You missed absolutely nothing. You got it exactly right. That's what makes for good ethical issues, is when you have competing imperatives. We have the imperative that says we want to help these people, and we have the imperative that says that we want to protect the people who are doing the helping. And absolutely, that's exactly the problem. And that's why you don't, because of the second imperative, that's why you don't see a bankruptcy provision. Because we don't want to overbalance to the point where we're going to harm the lender. But we're never going to satisfy both. You can't satisfy both at the same time. You try to get into some middle ground where you're enabling a credit and you're not strangling the creditor. You're right. We have 2 different goals. towards the same end fundamentally, because if you drop your second one, you won't have your first. If you don't protect creditors, you will not have any help for the needy. Yeah?
My question is, is that the same all the time? Is the Bible or the Torah deals with it the same? So let's for example, a lady, a widow, that lost her husband, and she needs to feed her children, and she accumulates that, and then another person that just wants luxurious stuff, and he goes in debt, and does the Torah deal with both
right.
the same way, or they linear toward this woman then?
Right. So the Torah does differentiate in a couple of ways. Good point. One way in which the Torah differentiates comes to something we'll discuss in the third week, which is when we talk about arrangements that are made for debtors who can't pay. So when we talk about what you're allowed to claim from their property for payment of the debt, arrangements are made to make sure they won't have certain things, certain necessities, so she'll be taken care of in that way. That's one example of it. A second is, I mentioned before, that it is considered meritorious and philanthropic for somebody to forgive the debt. Even though there's no law on the books about bankruptcy, it's considered a good thing to do, to forgive it. That's the tzedakah. And that's part of, then, what we're going to look at as a safety net for the widow in the case that you mentioned. I should also note, outside of this entire discussion is the general mitzvah for society to help people in need. And it's not, what we're saying effectively is, it's not on the shoulders of the creditor to be the one to do that. It's on the shoulders of the community. So, for example, when we're going to talk about claiming certain things from a debtor for payment of the debt, we're going to say the creditor may well claim it, and then the community is going to have to make up for it. The community is going to be, but we're not going to say it's not the lender's problem, it's the community's problem. It would be kind of cruel when you think about it. The one who gave the loan is now going to, we're going to force that person to shoulder the burden of helping the debtor. That's not fair. It's not his responsibility more than anybody else's. If anything, is less. So, that to me is a very important point in terms of why we never entertained a bankruptcy institution. I think was the both points are important. Number one, because it's a religious duty to repay, and number two, because of the fear that it would have a chilling effect on lending. So that brings us to another question now. We're talking about this practically. It's 2015. Someone wants to file for bankruptcy, and that person is Jewish. Will Jewish law recognize a secular bankruptcy discharge? And the answer is, of course, that is subject to debate, because we're Jews. But nonetheless, it is subject to debate, and there are three ways in which it might be recognized within Jewish law. The first way, I'm not going to discuss at length, is what's called pshara. Pshara means compromise. Okay? Compromise, settlement. In Hebrew, when you talk about hot water, water is cham. When you talk about cold water, it is kar. How do you say lukewarm water? Poshrin, exactly. Pshara, poshrin, it's the same term. And the idea is you meet somebody in the middle, and as a matter of fact, the Talmud has a discussion about the imperative to settle and try to find a compromise, and it's considered to be meritorious to pursue that first. So in the event that the sides agree to a compromise, they agree, they shake hands, they whatever, that's fine. Then Jewish law will recognize it because that's taken care of. I'm giving a class on the topic, actually, of the pursuing a settlement at some point. It's going to be, I don't know, if I remember, I'll send out the link later on when I follow up to people who signed in. But there will be a class on negotiating a settlement. Okay. But that's the first. The second way it might be recognized is under the category called Dina de Malchuta Dina. Dina de Malchuta Dina, literally, the law of the government is the law. If you take a look at source number 11 on your sheet, this is the classic source for it. Going back to Roman times, the Mishnah here, the core text in source number 11, says, Ein portin lo mitevas hamochsin, etc. One may not use coins from the tax collector's box. And the idea is that I am not allowed to make change using coins from the tax collector's collection because it's viewed as stolen. The backstory here is the practice of tax farming, in which people would approach the government in Roman times and say, we would like to privatize tax collection. We're going to pay you a certain amount, and for that, we will gain the right to collect the taxes from the area. And the government was very happy, because certainly in their days, it's difficult to collect taxes now. Imagine what it was like then. They had no way of getting everything that they thought they had a right to. So the government says, well, we expect that we're going to collect $1 billion in taxes if we do everything perfectly. In practice, we're going to get, if we do this ourselves, after what we spend and what we don't get, we're going to make $300 million out of the billion. So what we would like to do is sell the rights to somebody for $500 million and then let him collect whatever he collects. That was tax farming. However, what would often happen is the person who purchased that right from the government would then charge as he chose to whatever population he chose. He could set up a toll booth somewhere, he'd go into a community and say, I think you can afford this, and therefore that's what you have to pay me. And he was fully licensed now to, not licensed in the sense of legal, but licensed in the sense that he had the power to do whatever he wanted. So this source says, the opening source in number 11, says, we view the tax collector's money as stolen goods, and therefore you can't use it in making change. To which the sages then ask the question in the Gemara, the commentary to the Mishnah, writing in, this is Shmuel, so he's the late 3rd century, V'amar Shmuel dina d'machusa dina. How could you say that it's called stolen goods? The law of the land, the law of the government is binding.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I can understand that in a democracy like, say, Canada, USA, but let's say you're dealing with the former communist empire, where there was corruption right, left, and center.
Okay.
Especially, I visited four of those countries. And the government officials themselves are stealing right, left, and center. So how would this law of democracy be done?
So I would say two things. First of all, I was listening to 680 on my way here, and I heard this whole thing about satellite offices and some, you know, millions of dollars needing to be repaid because they were used inappropriately. So I think that we may be in a glass house on that front. But in terms of the broader question. Hang in there a little bit, because I'm going to talk about why the law of the government is respected, and then we'll see where it should apply or where it should not apply. But the default assumption is, as the sage Shmuel said in the 3rd century, the law of the government is the law. So they answer that that's talking about the tax collector who doesn't have a fixed rate. He's doing whatever he chooses to do, however he chooses to do it, or worse, a self-appointed tax collector, which is what we call a thief. So in those cases, that's where we don't recognize it. But normally, the law of the land is binding. Why is it binding? So there are several different theories that are put forth. One theory is because they have the keys. Right? In the same way that when you're in school and some kid brings a football to school and you want to know, well, by what rules are we going to play? The answer is, it's his football. So he gets to decide. You want to live in this land? The government says, it goes. They are the owners of the land. How did they become the owners? They may have conquered it. They may have been born into it. Doesn't make a difference. If you don't like it, live somewhere else. But that's one take, and under that take, you may say, well, they're being unethical, they're breaking the rules that they made, and so on. And the answer may be, so what? It's theirs. You know, it's not nice, but that may be true. Another view is that the authority comes from one of the Noahide laws. We know that the Torah gives laws that are just for Jews, and then it also gives certain laws that are for all human beings. And one of the laws that's for all human beings is the law of setting up courts. All human beings are obligated, wherever they live, to set up a judicial system. So, the argument goes, you can't tell me that on the one hand, humanity is obligated to set up courts, and on the other hand, I don't have to respect their laws. That doesn't work. If you're going to obligate people to set up laws, you're personally obligated as well to honor those laws. And so that's a second argument. And then I would only have to honor the laws, assuming that it was a properly structured system, the sort of thing that they're obligated to set up. A third argument is that it's simply social contract. society agrees that these are going to be the laws, and therefore you're obligated. Key question that emerges from this is, what is the scope of the law of the land is the law? And this is where it's going to come to bankruptcy. How far does our recognition of the law of the land go? Well, if you take a look at source number 12, Rabbi Yosef Colon Trabata, writing in Italy in the 15th century, says the following: Shayach lememer dina demalchusa dina, demalka omer shei karka shalo kanui ba'oso shtar. He says it's possible to say the government's law is the law, because the king, in a particular case, says his land may be acquired with their designated document, and therefore I have to use the document that the king says. But he says, even according to those views that say that government law is the law in other monetary matters, things that are not about the document that the king says must be used to transfer land, someone takes a broader approach. That is specifically for head taxes and other practices of the king, obviously. In civil law, it is most obvious this is not so, for with this you would cancel all of the Torah's laws, God forbid. What he's saying is, this view of Rabbi Colon, is that the when we say dina de malchusa dina, the law of the government is the law, what we really mean is the law that affects the governor is the law. There are certain laws which the government puts in place which are about them, making sure that the government will be okay. But then there are laws that the government puts into place that have nothing to do with anybody who's governing, but are just for society in general. So the classic example is speed limits. It doesn't affect the king whether I speed or not. And you switch that into a democratically elected government and it's the same point. It doesn't affect them if somebody speeds on some road out in the middle of Alberta. That, according to Ma'arik, according to Rabbi Colon in source number 12, is not covered by this. It's only that which affects the king, because he's taking the theory that the law of the land is the law, is really because it's his land. So if it's his land, he gets to make the law, and on things that affect him, I have to follow it. That's one approach. However, it is not the only approach. I brought another source. Actually, which ones did I choose to bring on there? No, I didn't bring this on there. But there's another source that suggests just the opposite. Since it's about social contract, any law that affects the general population is binding, because it's about society as a whole. It's not really about a king. It's about the community. And if the community benefits when people drive under a certain speed, then it's going to be binding on me, because it's for the sake of the community as a whole. There are other theories along the way, but this is now going to affect us in terms of bankruptcy. Who's benefiting? Remember I said it's going to matter, this question of why we have bankruptcy legislation. Who is the beneficiary of bankruptcy legislation? Sorry? The borrower is one of them. We had this whole discussion, right? Society is the beneficiary of this legislation. So if I take the view that the law of the land is binding, is more than just that which affects the government personally, and it's about whatever benefits society, then if society chooses to create bankruptcy legislation, all citizens will be required to honor it. If you take a look at source number 13, I bring you a piece from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Oh, number 14. Don't worry about number 13 anymore. It mattered before. But take a look at number 14. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, writing in, as you see there, this was in the U.S., in the latter part of the 20th century, and dealing with a discussion of corporate bankruptcy, he says, "It appears certain, in the interest of time, I'm switching over to the English, it appears certain that even those who accept government law in all matters only accept established government law in matters of transactions and payments of debts from one's assets, for the government would suffer if there were different laws among the people. It could lead to jealousy and competition and strife. This might appear to relate only to the laws of government-appointed national judges, but perhaps the king would also be concerned that other judges not judge in other ways which could cause challenges to the nation's laws." What he says there, what Rabbi Feinstein says, is that the government, even if you're going to tell me, if you're going to tell me that it's only about that which affects the government personally, he says laws for how loans are collected, extended and collected, affect the government directly. The government is going to suffer if there's strife among people. If certain people are following some laws and certain people are following other laws, it's going to create trouble. And on that basis, Rabbi Feinstein says that indeed Jews would be obligated to recognize a secular bankruptcy law. That's the position of Rabbi Feinstein. Others disagree. If you take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Breisch, as you see writing in Europe and also in the 20th century, earlier than Rabbi Feinstein, you know, I am going to have to go back to source number 13. I thought that that skipping it wouldn't be an issue, but I see that I can't. If you go back to number 13, this is within the context of the discussion of why we recognize the government's laws. So Rabbi Moshe Isserles, one of the great Ashkenazi authorities of Jewish law, writing in the 16th century, beginning to the middle of the 16th century, says, we don't recognize government law other than in matters that benefit the king or that benefit the citizenry. But not, he says, to judge by the laws of idolaters. That would cancel all of the laws of Israel. He says, I'm not willing to accept idolaters here. He means society in general. He says, we're not going to handle our cases in court by the laws of secular society, but we'll recognize laws in matters that benefit the king or benefit the citizenry. So,
yeah. That's regarding our monarchy. Suppose we've got a republic. So, who would be considered as the chief head of this context?
Where do you see that it's about monarchy?
If you were talking about benefiting the king,
right,
and then you've got a republic, how does Dino Democracy Dino then affect the head of leadership? Who is going to be the head of the leadership instead of the king in this context?
Right. So if I take a theory of law of the land that recognizes the government because they own it, so whoever is given the right to go to war, the right to levy taxes, whoever that is going to be the one. If I take social contract, then certainly a democratically elected government is going to be honored based on social contract. That's the whole idea of democracy. So it actually won't make a difference. But in source number 15, Rabbi Breisch takes a more restrictive position. He says, even according to Rabbi Isserles, whose words we read in source number 13, who especially elevates the principle of honoring government law, extending it even to the benefit of the citizens. He says, even if it's just benefiting society, nonetheless we honor it. What benefit for the citizens would apply in our case, he writes, stealing this person's assets because the borrower is temporarily unable to pay? He says, bankruptcy legislation is stealing from the creditor. That's the way he looks at it. And therefore, his argument is to say, no, we are not willing to honor bankruptcy legislation. So we have two different views as to whether honoring the law of the land would mandate accepting a bankruptcy settlement or not. Yes?
There's a kind of occurrence, maybe in the last 50 years, a phenomenon where you have the phrase too big to fail,
yeah,
that a government will bail out a company or it'll go easier, like we have CCCA proceedings for larger companies that are going bankrupt.
Right.
And a lot of times people will argue, well, the people's interest and the government's interest are one and the same. Because if this company, this multi-billion dollar, you know, what they call a national champion, like
sure,
Bombardier, goes under, all the jobs are gone and
yeah,
all this stuff is gone. So you could argue as well that, you know, when bankruptcy laws are in place, they do affect the citizens, but it also does affect the government because the government is not going to have the tax windfall from that company if it goes under.
Interesting. So how direct does the benefit have to be in order to call it the benefit of the government? Rabbi Feinstein's formulation was very broad. He was allowing for indirect benefit, right, when he said that the strife that will be caused because people are judging by different standards is in and of itself going to be a cause of harm to the government. So I think certainly if I can accept his writing on that, then I can accept what you're saying about the tax losses for the government if a large entity were to suffer this. I can take one more question from Jeff, and then there's a little bit more to finish here.
Do these considerations apply equally to a Jewish borrower who may have to declare bankruptcy versus the Jewish creditor versus a professional a Jewish professional advisor advising a Jewish or non-Jewish client versus somebody just engaged in regular business. In other words, do you think these opinions would apply differently to me personally or to me as someone who's just active in business and may encounter a bankruptcy situation, and is it ethical for me to have anything to do with it at all?
Right. So I'm going to get to the question of the advisor, actually, in a couple of minutes. But in broad terms, if I'm taking this as being about the borrower's obligation to repay, so this clearly affects the borrower, whether I recognize the bankruptcy statute or not. And beyond the borrower, there is a principle of lifnei iver, that a lawyer, let's say, or an advisor, is not allowed to cause him to stumble by doing something inappropriate. So therefore, he would be allowed or not allowed to help based on whether the bankruptcy legislation is recognized. The creditor argue, I choose not to recognize the bankruptcy legislation. Once again, if we accept law of the land, then he's going to be bound by law of the land just as much as the borrower is. So he wouldn't be able to make that argument. So yes, I think it affects everybody. In one way or another, it's going to affect everybody involved. Now, I said there were three ways in which Jewish law might recognize this. The first way was if there's a negotiated agreement between them, there's a compromise. The second is by virtue of law of the land, that even if law of the land says the creditors vote, and there's some minority creditor who says, well, I didn't accept this, nonetheless, bankruptcy legislation is going to say, too bad, you're stuck with the terms of the agreement because most of the creditors agreed to it. The third and last point in it is what's called in Hebrew minhag socharim, the practice of business in general, a local commercial practice. And making a long story short, we have ample sources. I brought you one in source number 16. But we have ample sources that recognize the authority of local practice to determine what will be recognized by Jewish law. So, for example, when I hire somebody, the hours that they're going to have to work, by default, are the same as whatever is the industry standard for their field. We can choose to negotiate whatever we like. But in the event that it's not specified, then it's whatever is normal within that industry. That's called minhag socharim, local practice. And so, following that idea of that local practice is binding, you could apply that to bankruptcy as well. And say that when someone extends a loan, he's doing it knowing that whatever is locally done with loans could apply to the loan that he's extending now. So the loan that he's extending may not be repaid, because that's what we do. We have bankruptcy possibilities, and that's accepted as part of the extension of the loan. And so that's a third argument, is that the local commercial practice, even if you don't recognize law of the land, but whatever is locally done, may automatically be binding. So those are the three, those are the three principles. So the final point, and then I'll summarize, if I am if I'm asked to serve as an advisor to a Jewish client who wants to file for bankruptcy, assuming that the client is legitimately unable to pay, there's no deception involved, and that's all, that's all straightforward. So, is the bankruptcy agreement legitimate in the eyes of Jewish law? Is using these proceedings as subversion of his religious duty to pay his debts? So, if bankruptcy is legitimate through one of the means that we've discussed, then yes, it's legitimate for this borrower, and therefore it's legitimate for me to assist the borrower. That's the essential argument. There's a separate point, which we've discussed, I think, a couple of years ago here. There's a principle within Jewish law of not going to secular courts in litigation with other Jews. There's the idea that by going to a secular court, either you are showing disrespect to the Jewish court system, you're showing a lack of respect in the Jewish court system, you're endangering the continuity of the Jewish courts, and so on. However, Number one, in the event that one needs to go to the secular court because, let's say, the other party in the litigation isn't interested in going to a rabbinical court, so there is a procedure for getting licensed to go to the general court system. That's point number one. But point number two, which Professor Reznikoff points out, and I brought it in source number 22, this may be different altogether because this is really, it's not suing somebody. It's what's called an in rem proceeding. If you take a look at source number 22, bankruptcy is technically an in rem proceeding, i.e. the debtor does not affirmatively sue anyone in court. Instead, the debtor merely appears before the court and seeks its relief, at least where there is no dispute as to the debtor's eligibility for a discharge. Right? There's no deception, no challenge going on in that regard. The secular court arguably does not adjudicate legal issues between parties. That's not what's going on. In such cases, by filing for bankruptcy relief, the debtor is essentially applying to a government office for a special permit or benefit, not submitting to a court for the resolution of a dispute. So therefore, that whole concern about going to courts outside of the Jewish court system may not be relevant at all. So to summarize what we've said in 30 seconds or less, we've seen that there is a mitzvah of repaying debt, that bankruptcy law evolved in general society over the centuries, but Jewish law never really created such a proceeding. We suggested two reasons for that. One, there's an obligation to repay debt. And number two, because we don't want to harm creditors to the point where they will not extend loans, which we view as philanthropically necessary for society. We asked whether Jewish law would recognize the discharge, and we said that there are three ways in which it might, subject to debate. First, if there is a properly negotiated compromise that everybody has agreed on, they've performed what's called a kinyan, an act recognized in Jewish law as sealing a transaction. Second would be if you say it's valid as part of the law of the land for the benefit of society / benefit of government. Or third, if that's simply local commercial practice, and therefore when you extended the loan, you understood that it would be negotiated and dealt with on those terms. If I accept any of those three, then being the advisor for somebody who wants to enter into bankruptcy would be 100% legitimate. As always, there is much more to say. I'm going to stick around to discuss questions if people have them. Keep in mind, we continue for the next 2 weeks. And if you didn't sign in yet, where is the sign-in sheet right now? Great. If you didn't sign in yet, please do, because I like to follow up afterwards on questions that come up, including to send out the link that I mentioned earlier. Again, Reem, thank you so much for setting this up.
Thank you very much, Robert.